Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We'll have the latest on North Korea's nuclear test at the bottom of the hour. But we start on this Memorial Day with a conversation about war, a conversation that may be about 65 years too late. We've all seen the iconic picture of the sailor kissing the nurse in a confetti-filled Times Square when World War II ended. We've been told veterans of the Vietnam War didn't get the hero's welcome that World War II troops received. And more recently, Iraq War vets suffering post-traumatic stress were reportedly taunted by their superiors to buck up like the Greatest Generation did. Well, a new book goes a long way to shatter some of the myths about World War II vets.
They had, after all, spent months, perhaps years in harm's way. They'd experienced the horrors of battle and endured conditions of appalling brutality. Many had suffered grievous wounds, had watched buddies die. They themselves had killed. Even those who had no direct experience of combat, and that was the vast majority of veterans, had been separated from family and friends for protracted periods of time, sometimes for 2 or 3, even 4 years, with no furloughs home, no telephone conversations with parents, fiancés, wives, or children. Now they would be returning. What would they be like? How would the war change them? How would it change those waiting at home?
Author Thomas Childers reading from his terrific and heartbreaking new book, Soldier from the War Returning, The Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. Some stats. In 1946, 7,000 men had to wait for hospital beds. 500,000 disability claims went unanswered. 10,000 men a month were reporting to VA hospitals for what was then called psychoneurotic disorders. And those were the men who got help. Of course, millions didn't need it, but millions more did. Thomas Childers is professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, 16 million vets came home. You write, yes, there was the GI Bill, but still, unemployment 3 times for vets what it was for civilians. And you describe veterans living in cars, chicken coops, a couple sleeping in the window of a department store display?
That's absolutely right. There had been very few houses built during the Great Depression and even fewer during the Second World War. So when this tidal wave of GIs began washing across the country in 1945, 46, 47, there was simply not enough housing. So GIs were living in all sorts of things. Streetcars that had been decommissioned, former army barracks, as you say, a couple that bedded down in a bedroom display in a New York department store, a couple sleeping on the stage of a Manhattan theater. There were over about a million and a half veterans who were living either with family, friends, or simply squatting somewhere.
And living with family and friends, we'll hear more about that. That put even more strain on these fragile, for many of them, very new marriages that they'd only briefly had before they went off to war, which is probably why, here's another statistic, between 1945 and 46, the United States recorded the highest divorce rate in the world. 500,000 marriages would dissolve in 1945.
During the Second World War, there was a huge surge in marriages. It seemed like everybody was getting married. And that surge in marriages continued after the war. But what's often forgotten, indeed almost always forgotten, is that Americans also divorced in record numbers when the war ended. In 45, it hit an all-time high. 46 was the highest peak in what was called the post-war divorce boom. These are numbers that weren't equaled until 1974. What's interesting, I think, about that as well is that, of course, most people think of the divorce wave of the late 60s and into the 70s as being a product of the sort of baby boomer 60s phenomenon, and that's true. But the second group most likely to divorce were, in fact, boomers' parents.
Well, and one last sort of something to put this in context, the sense of what returning soldiers would be like was pretty stunning. You tell of lurid tabloid headlines, will your boy be a killer when he returns? But it wasn't just the tabloids. A Columbia professor says the veteran, unless renaturalized in camps, is going to be a threat to society. People were very nervous of and in some ways sort of tired of returning vets. Tell us more about that.
There was a lot of talk about a crime wave, the coming veteran crime wave. There was even some speculation that returning veterans might be fodder for right-wing organizations such as they had been in Europe after the First World War. There's a lot of attention paid, and rightly so, to the GI Bill. But by 1946, toward the end of the year, you begin to get a sense of impatience on the part of civilians. One of the most common slogans or comments that one heard during the war when anybody complained about anything was, don't you know there's a war on? By 1946, it was also quite common to hear the war's over, soldier. The major media, really talking about magazines now, ran stories. One of my favorites that is really indicative of the period was one called "Are We Making a Bum Out of G.I. Joe?" This was in the Saturday Evening Post.
Meaning, are we coddling them?
Yes. One of the aspects of the G.I. Bill had been for veterans coming back and having difficulty finding a job, that they were guaranteed $20 a week for 52 weeks. Some veterans very publicly announced that they were joining what they call the 52-20 Club. That is, after years away or in combat, were going to take a vacation at government expense. Very few actually did this, but you can imagine the cases of men who did got a lot of public attention, and there really was a reaction against this.
We're talking with Professor Thomas Childers, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, but also author of the new book, Soldier from the War, Returning the Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. On this Memorial Day, remembering with our rose-colored glasses off what post-World War II was truly like, Professor, you trace the lives of three soldiers and their families and how the war affected them. There was Michael Gold, a navigator whose plane was shot down. He was a POW. His two parents and younger brother waited for him in New Jersey. There was Willis Allen. He lost both legs. His wife, Grace, and his toddler, Judy, moved to be near him in Atlantic City and later in D.C. when he came home and recovered. And then this gets personal. Because the third couple, your own father, Tom, and your mom, Mildred, briefly married before he left for 2 years. He was stationed at an air base. What did he do in the war, you know, as the line goes?
Well, my dad was in the 8th Air Force, the 390th Bomb Group, a B-17 outfit, but he worked on the ground. He was not a flyer. He had a very as safe a job as one could have and still be in a combat zone.
And yet, you describe, and the book gets very graphic, and I'm so glad that it does, because we sort of need to hear what really happened to many of these men. Your father would see the planes return, often with brains splattered across them, and without the people he had sent out.
That's right. When he first went, like so many boys, really, men of that generation, he saw the war almost as a sort of romantic experience. Here he was, an ocean voyage. He's in England. He goes to London, to Cambridge. But that didn't last. Every day he would go out when the planes took off for their missions and watch the planes take off. And then in the afternoon when they returned, he would be there, as all the men on the ground would be, to watch to see how many of the planes made it back. Almost every time they went out, some planes didn't make it back. And even for some that did, there would be really grisly things, men who had lost an arm, a head blown off in the cockpit. He saw all of this. He had a close friend, a guy named Fatty Means from Illinois. And Fatty was a radio operator on one of the planes. He had flown 24 missions. He had one last mission to fly, to complete his tour of duty of 25. Only about 30% of flyers actually succeeded in doing that in 1943-44. So everything was ready for Fatty to return from this 25th mission. His plane made it back, but Fatty had been killed by a shell over Berlin. And I think for my father, that was a real turning point. There was no more romance to the war. And after that, he simply stopped making friends among the men who flew.
Yeah. And then, as we said, Michael Gold, more than a year as a POW, and Willis Allen, losing both legs. All three men come back to this America that we described, not enough jobs, moving in with relatives, trying to overcome disabilities, and hearing people thinking they're not the same. What is the phrase that starts to come up?
He was never the same after the war. There was a young man in my hometown, small town outside of Chattanooga, who wandered the streets, sun up to sundown, day after day, season after season. He would walk from telephone pole to telephone pole, placing his hand up on that silver oval plaque that's on all telephone poles, and looking at it as if it held some special communication for him. Then he'd proceed to the next one and the next one and the next one, all the way through town. My mother would always say when we saw him, I was a little boy at the time, would say, well, that's Mr. Westerberg, such a bright boy. He was never the same after the war. Nobody knows exactly what happened. I mean, there are a lot of stories about what happened to him. But I discovered later, when I began doing this book, that he had been the valedictorian of the local high school in 1937, and he had gone away a golden boy and come back a ghost.
Yeah. You mentioned your mother. There's another scene, and I can't remember which of the wives, mothers it was. A child comes across the mother after a horrific fight because all of these men start to inexplicably explode in rage and violence and anger. And the mothers develop their own battle fatigue, and the kids, some of them, say they feel like POWs. What starts to happen in the families after these men return?
All three of these men, I should say, were men who were not paralyzed by the war. That is, they didn't wind up in VA hospitals. They were men who would outwardly conform to all of those generalizations we have about the greatest generation. They all came back. They had families. They built successful careers and so on. But their war leached out in all kinds of corrosive ways. Mike Gold, who was a brilliant OBGYN, went to medical school when he got out of the Army using the GI Bill.
He'd been the POW, yep.
He'd been a POW for 15 months, and as a Jewish POW in Germany, this was a particularly harrowing experience. He almost starved to death in the prisoner of war camp. When he returned, he picked up, got his medical degree, had a family, a very successful practice in New Jersey, but he was subject to the family and to others, absolutely inexplicable bursts of rage, often triggered by food. A child who wouldn't eat all of his lima beans, or something like a candy bar not coming out of a dispenser, discovering that they didn't have shrimp at the Howard Johnson's on the New Jersey Turnpike, and absolutely lowering the boom on some unsuspecting waiter or waitress.
Or machine. He smashed the glass on the vending machine. He dumped a bowl of food on top of his own toddler's head. These are the pictures you didn't see in Life or Look magazines.
No, not at all. And one of the other men that I follow, Willis Allen, the man who lost both of his legs. And I have to say, he lost his legs above the knee with only a few inches of leg extending down from his hip. So, I mean, really a very, very severe handicap and wound. Willis, when I knew him, he was my best friend's father and lived a couple of doors down. By day, was just a terrific guy. He was handsome. He was funny. He was very talented. But at night, something would set him off. He became, I think, jealous of his wife, wondering why she wasn't home. Something would set him off, and my friend Gary and I and Judy, his older sister, simply learned we moved a dresser over in front of the door to make sure that he couldn't get in.
Mm. Thomas Childers' book, Soldier from the War, Returning, the Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. Again, he says many veterans did adjust well, and he doesn't even get into the problems faced by returning African-American troops. But when we come back, what happened to the soldiers he did follow, who all thought everyone cried out in the night from tortured nightmares and were told to buck up? So they clammed up. Also later today, a plan to save newspapers, but we'll be back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Thomas Childers, author of Soldier from the War Returning, The Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. It's a history that's been somewhat airbrushed from our national memory, but there are a few reminders. Here's a scene from the 1946 movie The Best Years of Our Lives, starring Harold Russell, a real veteran who lost both hands to the war, and encounters another man who says the U.S. was suckered into the war.
I've seen a ship go down and over 400 of my shipmates went with it. Were those guys suckers?
That's the unpleasant truth.
Oh, if I only had my hands.
You put those down!
Thomas Childers, your premise is that the public soon lost interest in these veterans and turned its attention to the communist threat, but that your research really touched a nerve.
When I began doing this work, there was literally nothing about this. And as the Philadelphia Inquirer did a story and it was syndicated nationally, I was deluged with people from all over the country writing, saying, this was my family. My family went through this. My father was never the same. And also said that comment, he was never the same after the war, was something heard over and over and over again. And so I thought this was a story that ought to be told. if, for example, we had had some better understanding that the costs of war in human terms are always the same. It doesn't matter whether it's a so-called good war or a bad one. I mean, I think for so long we assumed that Vietnam was bad war, bad outcome, bad after effects. And then we have to learn all over again, it seems, in Iraq and Afghanistan, that lo and behold, we have veterans coming back, women now as well as men, who are having all of these same troubles that we associated with Vietnam. And in fact, they were all there before in the so-called good war. So what seems to me is that the message is that there may be times when it's necessary to send men into harm's way, but the cost is colossal. And the suffering doesn't stop when the shooting does.
Well, Michael Gold, the former POW you write about, becomes part of a wave of World War II vets who get treatment for PTSD in their 70s and 80s. Willis Allen, who lost both legs, pretty much destroyed his family, violent fights with his wife, toppling to the floor from his wheelchair, crawling after her. She would taunt him, sometimes strike back, smashing him over the head with a hammer. But what happened to Tom and Mildred, your mom and dad, was more nuanced. Tell us.
He came back to a family that was deep in grief. His brother-in-law, my mother's brother, Howard, was a flyer in the 8th Air Force and had been killed in the last American bomber shot down over Germany in the war. I'd written a book about this called Wings of Mourning. My father came home, and after desperately wanting to see his wife to celebrate his survival, came back to a family that was overwrought with grief. He understood the terrible calculus of war and the probability of casualties, and he had become coarsened to it, to put it bluntly. I mean, this was simply, you couldn't dwell on it. When he came back, this attitude shone through, and my mother was quite unhappy with him.
Well, and also it eclipsed any opportunity he might have had to talk, because how could he complain? Because he came back.
That's right. And then I think for her, there was something else. And that was that in those initial weeks that he was home from the war, she discovered a letter which she thought was evidence that he had had an affair with an English woman. He denied it. She would not believe his denial. So somehow, in her thinking, these two things were wires that crossed. And I think in my family, unlike the Golds and the Allens, it was my mother who had PTSD about the war. And at one point, my mother, in the throes of anguish, yelled at him, "Why have you come back and Howard didn't?" And it was a sentence that hung over their marriage for the rest of their lives.
Well, and they stayed together for decades, although there would be very low points and high points, very high points. They did extraordinarily well. They had the country club circuit at one point, but then he borrowed money, went into debt at another point. So they yo-yoed up and down. But I guess my question for you, through all of this, did anyone ever talk about what happened in the war?
No. My father told stories, but they were always funny stories. He never, ever, for example, mentioned Fatty Means, this close friend of his, whose body my father had taken to the military cemetery in Cambridge for burial. I was at a reunion of the 390th Bomb Group. My father wasn't there. And two of his old buddies said, "Tom must have told you about Fatty." And I said, "What?" I went back and said to my dad, I said, "You know, these guys told me about Fatty Means." And he never said a word about it. He just said, "Yeah."
And that was, of course, the friend that he sent off on a plane and never returned. Your dad dies of a heart ailment. And I wondered, Thomas Childers, there's a couple paragraphs at the end of the book after the funeral. And you'd think, you know, this is something, again, nobody in the family ever talked about. And a lot of us have a lot of pain over this, that we never really sat down and mined these stories. But who knows if our parents could have responded, if we wanted to. But this is decades after the war. Decades after the war. Could you read these couple of paragraphs after your dad's funeral?
The limousine from the funeral home carried Mildred, that's my mother, and her son back to the house and to the small collection of close friends who were waiting for them there. As they passed through the stone gates of the cemetery and down into town, she stared through the dark glass of the window, her features as frozen as the cemetery earth. They rode in frosty silence, lost in their own thoughts. Then, apropos of nothing, she said, as much to herself as to him. You know, he was never the same after the war. Those were the only words that passed between them on the solemn ride home. In those last dwindling years of the 20th century, 1,000 veterans of the Second World War were dying each day, an entire generation passing. And how many times each day, he wondered, were his mother's words being echoed as families folded the flags and said their final farewells, watching in mournful silence the coffins holding their veteran husbands, fathers, uncles, and brothers being lowered into the grave, their war over at last.
Thomas Childers, thank you so much for speaking with us and writing this book.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thomas Childers' book is Soldier from the War Returning. And as I always note on this day, if you happen to be in Long Island's National Cemetery, drop by Section V, Grave 239B, and say hello. And leave it to the BBC to find our next story. It's about cowboy churches, a loose network of them across this country, but especially in the Southwest. The preachers wear Stetsons and the faithful gather in stables and rodeo arenas. The BBC's Kevin Connolly attended a recent service in Lawton, Oklahoma.
If Christianity was born in a stable, then there's no reason, I suppose, why it shouldn't flourish in a rodeo arena. And since this is 21st century America, the stalls for every horse at the Red Horse Ranch in Lawton, Oklahoma, have individual air conditioning units. The worship on offer is simple and direct. Its props and themes borrowed from the Old West, or at least from movies about the Old West.
Amen. Let's just start getting on in here, song at Cowboy Church.
Just repeat this little prayer after me. Say, Jesus, forgive me for my sin. Help me in my life.
The preacher, Kelly Cronkite, dressed like many of the faithful in Stetson, Wranglers, and cowboy boots, delivers his sermon from the back of a wagon parked on the edge of the rodeo ring. It is old-time religion for places like Lawton, where they miss the simple certainties of the old times.
Wouldn't it be awesome if one of the families in the fires that went through, if you had the access and the ability to do it, you knew there was good, God-fearing people who lost everything, didn't have insurance, and needed a home, for you to go and be able to write a check and say, I believe God wants you to have that home.
To those of us who learned about cowboys from Hollywood, this is puzzling stuff. We remember the casual murders, the heavy drinking, and the dancing girls. And, of course, the darkness of it all, captured here in the off-duty thoughts of the Magnificent Seven.
Places you're tied down to, none. People with a hold on you, none. Men you step aside for, none.
Insults swallowed, none. Enemies, none.
No enemies?
Alive.
But of course, that's not the way cowboys are remembered here in the hard lands where they fashioned an American life out of a hostile and trackless wilderness.
There's many different images, and some are the Clint Eastwood, the shoot 'em up, or the person who is not family-oriented, who's not goodwill-type person. But in actuality, the cowboy is really honest. He's noble. He's brave. Some of those characteristics that produced the kind of people that built America.
All cowboys, you know, even the ones that were the rough and tough, they still believed in God. They knew God was the supreme being. They might not always live the life they should.
It's just a cowboy spirit. A lot of times these people don't feel comfortable coming to a conventional church, dressing up in a suit and a tie. So we put our cowboy hats on and our boots and our jeans, and we come and really appreciate the atmosphere and what it does for us.
Because if you're an outsider, you think cowboy, you think, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily lead very, you look at the movies, these guys didn't lead necessarily very moral lives.
Yeah, yeah.
All the shooting people, all the drinking.
Yeah, there's a stereotype there that is being broken.
And the minister, Kelly Cronkite, is the real thing, too, a former rodeo competitor who kept his faith in the sometimes godless world of the modern showbiz cowboy.
Started when I was a kid, team roped, mainly roped calves. You know, there's obviously the professional ranks. I was never a professional, but I was at a level of competition that was definitely a challenge. I had to work hard to get there. I had my kids do barrel racing and rope a little bit, and so we still rodeo on a junior level.
Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat."
The cowboy church movement is growing too, particularly out in the western United States. At the Red Hand Ranch, they have a crowded Sunday school class of polite children learning about the New Testament and the old days at the same time.
Lord, help me, Jesus. I've wasted it so.
This is, for the moment, a curiously American form of Christianity that blends the tough romanticism of the nation's founding myths with a simple but powerful religious faith. In places like Oklahoma, Texas, and Colorado, it is spreading, and already some of its preachers are wondering if the wider world might be ready for a new way of looking at the Old West.
My soul's in you.
A slice of America through a BBC lens from the BBC's Kevin Connolly. Can Stephen Brill save the newspaper industry? The man who launched Court TV, American Lawyer Magazine, and Brill's Content wants to create a service that he says will make it easier for newspapers to start charging people to read their online articles. Now, right now, the Wall Street Journal is the only major newspaper that has been able to get people to pay for subscriptions to its website. The Journal offers some articles for free, but for full access, readers have to pay. And almost every other newspaper gives its content away for free. Even the New York Times abandoned its Select service 2 years ago. That charged readers for premium content. So the question is, will people pay to read articles that they now get for free? Stephen Brill joins us. Welcome.
How are you?
I'm fine. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've proposed. One is called a micropayment, a small fee per article. Tell us how that would work.
Well, what we're actually proposing to do is equip newspapers to charge for their journalism in a variety of ways. The most likely way is likely to be an annual subscription online, maybe a monthly subscription, maybe a day pass, or in the case of people who happen onto an article and just want to read that article, there would be a provision for micropayments. Now, the reason that will work is that the main thing we're doing is going across multiple newspaper websites and telling newspapers that their customers will have one account with us, with one password, so that if they want to do a micropayment, they basically just have to type in a password. They don't have to go register and put their credit card up and do all that other stuff. And what we found and what most people know is that the big barrier to anything like, you know, deciding to pay, you know, 15 cents or 25 cents for an article that you really want to read is the hassle of filling out a lot of stuff so that you can do it.
Well, that is one hassle, but as you know, a lot of young people don't want to pay anything at all. They don't expect to have to pay. They never have. The LA Times writes, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube. Our media analyst, John Carroll, says the corn is off the cob. You know, people say you just can't change the way people think about this. They expect to get it for free.
Well, listen, I mean, people would like to get it for free, and they'd also like it to be Christmas, but it's not. And what they're going to get for free in the future is going to be nothing unless they do what they've been doing for 100 years, which is paying a small amount for journalism so that there's a balance between readers as customers and advertisers as customers, which is good for the independence of journalism. So we will sell a subscription to the Boston Globe if they're our affiliate on the Boston Globe website. We will also sell a kind of all-you-can-read subscription across, you know, hundreds of newspaper websites for maybe, you know, $20 or $30 a month, and we'll split that revenue according to page views. But the key initiative, first and foremost, is enabling newspapers through the kind of e-commerce engine that probably none of them can afford to or have the ability to build on their own, and giving people a common password and a common username so that they can do this in a very simple way. And we can try to put that toothpaste back in the tube. It's not as easy as if we did it 10 years ago, but, you know, I can't be responsible for the fact that, you know, every newspaper publisher in the world got together as if this was, you know, Jonestown and decided, you know, to commit suicide as a group.
You mean by not charging, by putting everything out for free to begin with?
You know, I have a daughter who's 25 years old who would rather read the New York Times online than read it as a newspaper. And the New York Times performs the singular miracle of giving it to her for free in the form she'd like and charging her for the form that she wouldn't like. In the weeks just before we announced this venture, the debate was, should newspapers be charging for their online content? Now, if you talk to any publisher, the debate is how and how much. There isn't a single publisher that I've talked to in the last 2-3 weeks who will tell you, for the foreseeable future, we're just going to give all our stuff away for free. No one says that.
Well, and how much is the question, and how much can make up the terrible shortfall? The New York Times says it's $75 million in the red. It blames most of that on the Boston Globe. Of course, that's a kerfuffle we don't want to get into. The Boston Globe, many people there feel they were bled by the New York Times. In 2008, advertising dropped $8 billion for newspapers overall. That's a lot of money to make up with a proposal like yours.
Well, let's remember that you still have today something like 46 or 50 million people every day buying a newspaper. And let's say they're spending, you know, 60 cents or 50 cents or a dollar. That's a lot of money that people are spending to read newspapers. If you could attract a tenth of that or 25% of that online, the profitability of that would be amazing because it doesn't cost any kind of money to deliver it online. You don't have to pay for paper, printing, delivery, and all the rest. And this is the important part. You don't have to give up your advertising revenue. And by the way, that's not a new model for publishers. The publisher of the Boston Globe newspaper is always wrestling with the balance between circulation revenue at the newsstand and advertising revenue in the print paper. They've always had that balance to wrestle with, and they've always been able to maintain it. It's just, you know, some idiots 10 years ago said, well, let's just do one side of the equation, and let's just get all this fabulous advertising revenue from online, and let's not charge people for it because, you know, some guy in his pajamas decided that, you know, information deserves to be free.
Well, we know that you are also hoping that your service will be almost an advocate for newspapers, a consultant to them. And one aspect of that is, telling other aggregators that they've got to start paying. Now, when Senator John Kerry held a hearing on newspapers, Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post said that aggregator sites such as hers aren't to blame for the demise of journalism. The problem is just that newspapers have lost advertising. But are you planning on going after or encouraging newspapers to go after people like Arianna Huffington and saying, you can't link to us anymore, you can't aggregate our work anymore without paying?
Well, there are two things. First of all, I don't think the Huffington Post is important enough to be a factor in this debate. But take Google News or take, you know, Matt Drudge, please. In those situations, first of all, if they link to an article that a newspaper is charging for, and you might even pay them a referral fee for linking to that article, then instead of those places being your parasites, they become your sales agents.
Are they going to do that, though? Are they going to pay?
If they link to something that is behind a paywall, then they're going to pay. If they take it without paying for it, that's easy. Not even they claim they have a right to do that. But it's a little hard to complain about the Huffington Post linking to your articles for free when you're giving it to everybody else for free.
What about Google News? Are you going to hold them to that same standard? They're cast as your biggest competitor.
I don't think they're competitors, and I don't think it's a matter of us going after anybody or holding them to anything. I think it's a matter of establishing a more balanced relationship, and the way to do that is, you know, Google is a big and admirably, you know, successful business that dwarfs any individual newspaper. But if a lot of newspapers get together and negotiate as a group with Google, it starts to right the balance of power.
So, Stephen Brill, how are you doing in this quest? Can you name names? Have you got the New York Times?
Not yet. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said, well, sometime in September we'll tell you who the names are when we actually launch. But the first focus is individual newspapers, lots of them, with their own websites, having the tools through our account system, our common password, to sell subscriptions, day passes, call it what you will, at whatever prices they want, with whatever combination of free and paid content that they choose, to be able to do that very quickly before more of them plunge, you know, further into the abyss.
Stephen Brill, co-founder of Journalism Online, a group attempting to get the toothpaste back into the tube and charge for online journalism. Stephen, thanks so much.
Happy to be with you.
Okay, and tomorrow on Here and Now, where will you be reading your newspaper in the future? We'll take a look at the workplace of the future. Chances are cubicles will be gone. Your boss might be a woman. What might work look like down the road? We'll take a look ahead. And before we go today, the song that soldiers sang on both sides of the divide, Lily Marlene.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. On this Memorial Day, an excerpt from a conversation we had last year about the song once loved by soldiers around the world.
Vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor, stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir.
It was born out of World War I, but took on new life during World War II. It was a German song, but Allied soldiers searched the radio dial to hear it. Lily Marlene is now also a book of the history of the song. We spoke to the then late 20-something authors, Liel Liebowitz and Matthew Miller, and began by asking Matt what drew him to the story of Lily Marlene.
I was reading a book, The Memoirs of Fitzroy MacLean, who is the inspiration for James Bond, British super spy, 1942, behind enemy lines in North Africa. And he was writing about the loneliness and how desperate the situation seemed at the time, and that the only thing that really gave him joy, that he could really look forward to and kind of ground him, was a song that was played out of enemy radio, Radio Belgrade, every night at 9:57, and it was Lily Marlene, a German song. And I thought to myself, this is so strange, I've never heard this story. So I asked Liel about it, if he'd ever heard of the song Lily Marlene, and he said he had. His grandmother used to sing it to him. And just a little more searching, we realized there was actually a great story behind the song.
Well, you learned the song was actually a poem written by a World War I sentry?
Hans Leip, he was a bohemian prototype who really deeply opposed the war and found himself one evening standing in front of the barracks gate in Berlin. And here he is, and to his left there's the officer's quarter, and there's light and happiness and music. And to his right is the train station, which, you know, picks up fresh young men to battle every week and then returns kind of like mangled corpses. And he's standing there underneath the lamplight, which is the first line of the song, and thinking about the time when the war would end, when he would come back to engage in the one activity that he liked most, which was womanizing. And he made this composite character out of two lovers he had, Lily, who was his landlord's daughter, and Marlene, who was this free-spirited art student who he'd met and had a fling with.
Tell us the lines of the poem. Why don't you do that? Can you read us some of the first few lines?
Well, I'm reading from the English translation that Marlene Dietrich made famous, but it says, underneath the lamplight by the barracks gate, darling, I remember how you used to wait. And it's really the story of a young woman waiting there underneath the lamplight for her lover to come back from the war, sort of assuming, as Hans Leip did when he wrote it, that the war would only last a few weeks and then normal life would resume, which obviously was not the case with World War I.
Twenty years later, it's turned into the song we know by Norbert Schulz, who writes the music, and it's recorded by Lala Anderson. But when it was first broadcast, it was November 9th, 1938, and it was the first night of Kristallnacht. So
yeah, not the best timing for a love song.
Well, there you have it. I mean, Kristallnacht, of course, when thousands of German Jews were arrested, deported, their synagogues, homes, businesses destroyed. Yeah, not the best time to introduce a love song.
The recording sold less than 300 copies and was turned down originally by nearly 30 recording companies.
So, Matt, tell us, where does it go next?
What actually happened was, as the Germans began occupying more and more countries, when they occupied Yugoslavia, they needed to set up a radio station. A young German whose passion was radio and who hated war himself, his name was Karl-Heinz Reintgen. He was tasked with setting up a radio station. He remembered a friend of his in Germany liked this song, and that friend was in North Africa at the moment. They put it into the rotation because they don't have that much to work with, and all of a sudden, they start getting letters from the front, from the Africa Corps. We love this song. Please play it again. It just became so popular. It really took on a life of its own.
And they played it every night before the evening news at 10 p.m. But soon, Radio Belgrade's signal starts to reach Allied forces. These are soldiers who don't speak German. So what was the appeal for them?
There are several answers to this. I think the first and sort of most common one is that if you listen to the melody, it's sort of like a perfect combination between a folk tune, a love song, and like a children's ditty almost. And it has a sort of like universal, almost like in terms of, you know, computers, almost this open source type of mentality into which you could write your own lyrics. And this is something that Matt and I found out. We discovered after 2 or 3 days that we were actually communicating with one another through the song. You know, I would say something like, hey, Matthew Miller, why don't you do some work? And it was really kind of amazing to discover that we were getting so into this and writing our own lyrics. But then we realized, of course, this is what the soldiers themselves had done, because many of them did not understand the lyrics but understood that this was a sweet, sentimental song.
Well, and let's listen to a version that the soldiers of the 8th English Army did. They retell their conquest of Africa in the song, and as you say, they sort of, you know, filled in their own lyrics. Let's listen to that.
Oh, soldiers never die. They're in the eighth army.
Out in the desert, the lonely sentry stood, thinking of hatchet and a possible Christmas pud.
There's something there, obviously. It tapped the zeitgeist. But what else was it that pulled these soldiers?
Well, I think one of the things is that this song is really fundamentally different than songs that are usually popular during wartime. I mean, if you look at the other songs that were sort of hits during World War II, you have things either very triumphalist marches like "We're Going to Hang Our Washington in the Siegfried Line," or you have songs like, you know, "We'll Meet Again," which are very sentimental and full of like pathos. But this one, it was so simple and straightforward and very clearly about a woman. Even if you didn't know the lyrics, you understood that Lili Marlin was a girl.
Wasn't it for, you write for many, you know, the woman they left behind?
The woman they left behind or the woman they were looking forward to coming back to, even if they had none back home.
Like a musical pinup girl.
Yeah.
So something for everyone.
It was not viewed favorably by higher-ups on either side. Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister and arbiter of culture, tried to have it suppressed. Why, by the way, Matt, did he not like it?
It didn't have the sentimentality of fire, of steel that he wanted Nazi music to have. Goebbels, for example, had written lyrics to be put to music for all the different Nazi invasions, tanks across Africa, bombs over England. So this is kind of the music that he thought the soldiers should be listening to in the field.
And Lille, Allied officers hated it because it was a German song.
Absolutely. I mean, to English minds, you know, kind of accustomed to the World War I model, a good soldier song was something like "It's a Long Way to Tipperary," something that it's very patriotic, that's very clearly English. And here comes this song that is in German, that is played every day at 9:57 on the Nazi-run Radio Belgrade. At some point in 1943, when they realized the song was unstoppable and they couldn't just suppress, you know, the soldiers listening to it, they commissioned an army officer by the name of Tommy Connor to say, "Just you go out and you have a weekend, record a version in English. We need to put something out there."
Underneath the lantern by the barricade, darling, I remember the way you used to wait.
Singer Ann Shelton with an English language version of Lili Marlin. Leah Leibovitz and Matthew Miller are the authors of the book Lili Marlin, The Soldier's Song of World War II. To hear our full conversation with them or to listen to other versions of the song, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Hope you are enjoying your Memorial Day. Please join us again here and now.
Orders came for sailing somewhere over there. All confined to barracks was more than I could bear. I knew you were waiting in the street. I heard your feet, but could not meet my Lily of the